best of y'all to brave the weather, and we'll go ahead and start taping now. I'm John Brand, and I'm Horns and Halos, and we're doing Understanding Our Needs, so that's for the tape, okay? I'm John Brand, what we're going to do today, the topic of the title for all four of these sessions is Horns or Halos, and I'm trying to help people understand why at times, you know, we sport halos and other times we spout horns. I mean, our behavior is not always the same all the time, unfortunately. I know you Lutherans are always angels, but as Methodists, we were horns, and so that, I'll speak from our perspective. Last time we talked more about some environmental issues, not ecological issues, but conceptual issues about the change from the modern to postmodern era. And today I want to go a little bit more into the behavioral aspects of this thing, and I want to start off with something that I'm sure most of you know, but I want to review it and maybe make some comments that might be new to you or unfamiliar to you, and that's Maslow's hierarchy of need. How many are familiar with that? I know you are, and everyone is okay. Maslow was a psychologist who developed the idea that human beings have needs. Well, that's not very original, but his contribution consisted in the fact that he felt that needs follow a certain orderly progression, and that lower level needs, and we'll define that in a minute, must be satisfied to some degree before a higher level need even kicks in. I think we need to say at the outset that no need needs to be satisfied 100% for the next level to kick in, but it has to be reasonably well satisfied, where you find some sense of satisfaction. Then when that happens, then without any volition, without any intent, without any willing, automatically, life sort of, it's like an automatic gear shift on the car. Life shifts forward into another level of need. And so the first thing I'd like to do is to kind of restructure the pyramid and have you go through that exercise with me there someday. They're more than enough. Those of you who are not familiar with the pyramid, what do you think is the most essential of all human needs? What's the primary thing that we have to have, which of course is the first need of life?
Food,
right. So in the first level, if you have a pencil, you want to fill it in, you can write in there food, and that's so obvious and self-explanatory that nothing else really needs to be said about it. I took down some quotations from Maslow's book, which is called Motivation and Personality. I think he wrote this about 1954, so it's an old book, but it's still standard. And this is what he has to say about this first need. A person who is lacking food and anything else in life at all would most probably hunger for food more strongly than anything else. So that the biggest need, obviously, is the need for food. Once the need is satisfied, and again, I iterate that we're not talking about having a steak every night and French fried potatoes and peas and apple pie a la mode, if that happens to be your bag, but the holding dinner will do just fine. So I'm just being facetious here. As long as we know where sort of our next meal is coming from, and we walk around with food in our belly, then life shifts us up to another level of need, which is, again, very basic, but it obviously is something quite different from food. And what do you think that is?
Love.
No, not yet. Not yet.
Shelter or?
Right. Shelter is what most people call it. Maslow calls it the safety needs. In other words, you have to have some sense of safety for yourself, which obviously for most of us means a house or an apartment and clothing and enough to keep the cold out and make us comfortable and make us feel reasonably safe and secure. He has an interesting comment, one that really quite candidly scares the bee willikers out of me as I look at our society. This is what he says. And here again, I want to iterate that, we might like to have a beautiful home in the suburbs with a swimming pool and tennis court, and five bedrooms or whatever, but that's not what you need to satisfy the need, that little old two-bedroom frame with a big mortgage on it. As long as you think you'll be able to pay it, that's all you need to satisfy the need. Now, but he makes this statement, and how in 1950, whatever it was, he understood this, because this was not a problem in 1950, I don't think. The safety needs can become very urgent under social scene whenever there are real threats to law, to order, to the authority of society. The threat of chaos or nihilism can be expected in most human beings to produce a regression from any higher need to the more prepotent safety needs, a common, and this scares me, almost expectable reaction is the easier acceptance of dictatorship or of military rule. In other words, when we are afraid because some nut in Austin will shoot at us while we're driving through the streets, I don't know if y'all had that problem or not where you're living, but Austin and San Antonio are rapidly becoming known for drive-by shootings. And people just randomly kill people. Certainly the lawlessness in terms of burglaries and has made us a nation that now puts bars on its windows and buys burglar alarm systems and buys police dogs. And this is not an exceptional occurrence, is it? We're beginning to be somewhat afraid. And what Maslow is saying is when safety begins to be an issue, and people may be quite willing to trade their freedom and get a dictator in order to have safety. And parenthetically, I might say, I was born and reared in Austria, so I went through the Hitler regime and have some, even though I was relatively young at the time, some deep appreciation for what Maslow is saying. When society breaks down and there seems to be no answer to our problems, people become, safety may include fear of loss of your job. I mean, if you can't make your payment on your mortgage, then you lose your safety. People might be quite willing to listen to an Ollie North who stands with some charisma before them and who says, "Trust me. I'll solve these problems for you." And he will. He'll solve them by rounding up all these undesirables, throwing them in concentration camps, and we'll have safety. But we'll do it at the price, Maslow is saying, of our freedom, because you might be the next one who might be an undesirable one. That's how this stuff works. So this gets to be a scary thing in 1990, whatever it is, three, as society does not seem to have a handle, government does not seem to have a handle on dealing with the lawless element in our society. And there are many reasons for that. I think the main reason is that the top of our social institutions are lawless themselves. I think that's probably the main reason. But that's, I'm not going to get into that. Okay. Any questions anywhere along the way, please stop me. Okay.
Am I supposed to write the first one on the big...
Yeah, the first one, the need for food goes, right, and you go up one step with each pyramid. In other words, the need for food goes in the big one, the need for safety in the second one.
John, may I make a comment
there? Yeah, I should.
When
I
was...
I did backwards that one.
Okay.
Oh, I did it backwards.
When I came into the village, I stopped over with my friends who are working in an inner city church, which is very much impacted by the drug scene. Mm-hmm. And my friend Holly Plain was telling me that there are children who look like they are starving from Somalia because they were born of drug-addicted mothers. And their whole digestive system is upset so that they're not hungry.
Yeah.
They won't eat.
Yeah.
And you put all these kinds of good food before them, and they simply don't eat. Their desire for food, they say, "I don't want it. I'm not hungry." And yet, he says they look like Somalia famine victims. So that the drug the effect of that has interfered with this basic need for food, which is pretty scary.
This is scary because I don't know what the consequence of that is, except that their bodies will obviously begin to crave drugs before too terribly long, you see. It's the same thing with alcohol. Alcoholics don't eat right.
Yeah.
You lose your need for food, and it's just a
These
drug, another
children.
Form of drug.
These,
yeah.
Are,
These are children who are born to parents who use drugs. Social problems are overwhelming, just overwhelming. And it's a breakdown of the societal contract that a culture has, you see. A culture is nothing but the result of a contract that we as individuals make, giving up our freedom in order for certain protections we get from society at large. And we're willing to give up some things in order to have protection.
You make the comment of this concern being an inner city problem, but it's a problem in the Bible Belt today as well as
it's
in San Antonio or wherever.
It's a problem every place, yeah. It's a problem every place, yeah.
You see, you're willing to give that up to live in Austin.
Yeah, yeah. For a while anyway. All right. Okay, now we've got a full belly and we got a place to sleep. So we meet the first two levels of the pyramid. Then automatically, without you doing anything about it, there's a shift in the automatic transmission of life. And it shifts you up to what need?
Love.
Okay. This is the word that's most commonly used. Maslow uses the word social. He also used the word love. First, in his original work, he used the word love, and then people began to be confused because love is such a confusing word, you know, the word qua word. So he used the word social. We have a need to interact with other human beings. And this, we cry out for that. Now, you know, for most people, this is a family relationship, maybe a marriage, but it doesn't have to be that at all. You have relationships with in the church and, you know, Sunday school class, and you have friends, and you have other human beings that you talk to, you visit with, and that you can identify with. And Maslow makes the very strong point that we'll come back to in a little bit. He said, one thing that must be stressed at this point is that love is not synonymous with sex. Also not to be overlooked is the fact that love needs involve both what?
Companionship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
taking and giving.
Yeah, giving and receiving, right, yeah. Absolutely, giving and receiving, yeah. And, you know, if one wants to be loved, one has to love. And this in our society again becomes somewhat difficult with the crazy idea we have that possible sexuality can be equated with love, and nothing is further from truth than that. If that were true, then people would, you know, most people would have reasonably high satisfaction of this need. Certainly married people would, and in our society unmarried people would too as things are going. But there is this need to interact with others. Okay, now when that takes place, once this third level is met to some degree, okay, then the dynamics of this pyramid turn inward. Food, shelter, others are external to myself. Now the pyramid turns inside the human being, herself or himself. And the fourth level, which is the first level of the internalization of human needs, Maslow calls what? Anybody remember that? It's called self-esteem. And self-esteem, let me read what he says. All people in our society, with a few pathological exceptions, have a need for stable, firmly based, unusually high evaluations of themselves, for self-respect, for self-esteem, and the esteem of others. I translate this to mean that on this level, you know, you get up in the morning and you may not feel well and the traffic may be bad and you may not like your boss, but you've got some realization that you're a person of worth and you need to work. You're a person of worth who needs to go out and for whatever reason, you see, make this contribution to the common life and then get a paycheck at the end of the week. Those of us in this room do not have a problem with these four levels. This is not our problem. We have food, we have shelter, may not be ideal, but you got something, place to live. Your social needs are met. You know, you may have a little problem with your spouse and all that, and your kids may give you headaches, and your parents may give you headaches, or whatever, and the job may not be ideal, but you're interacting, you're interrelated, you're out there mixing up with other people. You wouldn't be here if you wouldn't have a sufficient amount of self-esteem. The reason you're here is because you respect yourself. You think there is some value to your life. I know you got your problems, we all have, but there is a certain amount of sense of value and worth about yourself, at least subconsciously, that makes you feel that there is something in me that makes life worthwhile.
I've spent a long time struggling with that one.
Okay. Okay. But you see, the fact that you're struggling, that you're here working on it, you're not in a mental institution. Mm-hmm. If you were there, then I'd say you've lost. You know, you're going through a real severe episode of this struggle.
But you, I've seen the other side where you don't have a lot of self-esteem, you know.
Mm-hmm. That hurts.
It does take, you have to build up to it.
You have to build up to it. At any given time, and this is the thing, but these needs, you know, flexible. There are times that you're going to feel terribly frustrated and lonely, and you're not going to have self-esteem, and you get fired, and your self-esteem's out the window. I mean, this is a problem in our society.
20 years ago, we were emphasizing, I'm okay, you're okay.
Yeah, yeah. And that's all right. I don't anything, you know, it's...
Douglas John Hall last summer, when he was speaking of the different global mission events, said with economic situations the way they are, a lot of people are going to lose jobs or not have the kind of job they want. Mm-hmm. And so much of our identity is built on the kind of job we have. And he says one of the big jobs of congregations is going to be to build the self-esteem of people, that they are worth something even if they don't have a job. He says that's going to be a real challenge for the church, to uphold the self-esteem of people, yeah, in spite of what happens to
them. That's an excellent point. Yeah, it is a problem, you know. And here again, you know, this again scares me about our culture, is so many people out of work and people being afraid of their jobs, that they stifle these higher needs and get repressed to the safety need, where they're willing to vote somebody in that'll guarantee these things at the price of their freedom. Now, what happens to us? If you think you're through with your struggles because you've got self-esteem, I got news for you, you're not. Because once you have this modicum of self-esteem, again, the transmission shifts. And now we come to the critical point that really hurts most people in us. It hurts you and hurts me. And that's the need for what? Which now rears its presence. What does he call this? He calls it the need for self-actualization or self-realization. And what this simply means in his book, this is his definition, and please excuse the sexism here because he wrote this in 1950 some odd, so he says what a man can be, he must be. What a woman can be, she must be. Life puts a tremendous burden on you, psychologically, on us, that the people in Somalia don't have any idea about. Because they're down there on the first level, they don't know what self-actualization is. Good gracious, what is that? And even if they have a good crop this year, as all the newspaper reporters seem to indicate they will, they're going to struggle with building a shack. They're going to struggle with building a shack, and they don't know the problems that we have in a fairly technological culture where these lower level needs are reasonable and satisfied for most of us. Now life says, hey, you know what, you can be, you must be. There is a sense of deep fulfillment. And this ties into what this gentleman said, I've missed his name.
Douglas John Hall.
John Hall, Douglas, yes. That this is what we're struggling with in our congregation. I mean, here are people who want to be something, and they're locked into a certain job, or they're locked into a marriage that doesn't allow them to be what they think they need to be because of responsibilities, or they're locked into a cultural situation that stifles them, and we'll come back to the consequences of this in just a little bit. Now, most people who discuss Maslow stop with this level. They stop with self-actualization, but Maslow did not. He's got two more levels to the pyramid that most people don't realize. If you have some measure of self-actualization, and again, Maslow says in the history of the world there have been 15 people who have been self-actualized. Now, you just have very few totally self-actualized, but let's say that most people that we know have a modicum of self-actualization. We're struggling with this thing anyway. Now life pushes us up to another level of need. And this next level of need he calls something like order. That doesn't satisfy me. I call it wisdom. And I think he means that. I mean, it's a very broad kind of concept. You've got to struggle with the meaning of your own life from a point of view that has an answer to the substantive questions of existence. And the substantive questions are not, and this is what, you know, we have to help our congregations to understand, are not, will I get the promotion to become vice president of my division? It is not, will I become sales manager? It is not, you know, will I be able to buy a new house, split-level house in the suburb? These are not the substantive questions. The substantive questions are, what does it mean for me? And I'm using Halleck now, which is next week's sessions. But what does it mean for me to be in a loving relationship? Again, we come back to this. It goes back to the third level, but this needs to be thought through. What does it mean to love? What does it mean to be open to new experiences? You see, there's so many of us locked in life, and we're putting on a pretty good front, and we refuse to be open to new experiences, and we die. We're spiritually, emotionally, psychologically dead. Physically, we disintegrate and get ulcers. We're finite. And if we have some self-realization, what does that mean? That means that finitude we have is expanding towards the infinite, and we must open our new borders and new horizons, and we must be willing to look at things that 30 years ago we weren't willing to look at. New experiences, maybe quite different from what we think. Theologically, we may interpret the 148th Psalm a little bit differently than we did when we were seminary students. We haven't discussed that this morning. We may have to look at relationships and our responsibilities differently. What does it mean? And this is so fundamental in Halleck's value system. And I think a person who has wisdom must work this through. What does it mean for me to have to die someday? This is a sick society about death. I mean, it's sick. We're Christians, and our attitude towards death is just sickening. I can summarize it with the time when I was a small town preacher and we got a new funeral home, and the funeral director and I were pretty close. We had good relationships, and he showed me his new facility, and he pointed out to some kind of fanciful arrangement of lamps above where the casket would be. And he said, "John, this is the newest thing." He said, "See, one light bulb is blue and the other one is pink or some color like that, and it makes the body look as though he is still alive." And I said, "My goodness, how neurotic can we dead, you see? Can we be? We're dead and we refuse to recognize it because we're so afraid of it. We're not willing to face death." And Halleck says that when you're a person of wisdom, that's one thing you got to work through within yourself. Got to be able to face it. Okay, I could preach on that because that's one of my favorite topics. So I'll resist the temptation. What does it mean to live in a society under the law? These are the substantive questions, you see, that a person of wisdom needs to work through. And once we get involved in that perspective, now this cold, hard-headed psychologist, Jewell, says there's one more step. And he calls this the level of the transcendent. You've got to push through to some realization of whatever this schmear is that embraces all of life. What is this transcendent power, this transcendent force, this transcendent essence that grips human beings and grips all of creation in its totality? What's the nature of that? And the answer that you received in Sunday school ain't going to hack it. It's just not going to hack it. The answer your parents gave you is not going to hack it for you, because it's got to be your answer. And if you wind up some different place in what you learn in Sunday school, that's fine, isn't it? God's big enough to handle it. If he can't handle that, he can't handle anything. If your idea of Jesus changes, and if it doesn't change, you know, that's pretty sad. I mean, it ought to change from the time you sang What is it we sing, little children? Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look upon this little child. No, that's a prayer, isn't it? Oh, you know these children's songs we sing.
Jesus loves you.
Jesus loves me, that's the one. Yeah. Now, nothing wrong with that, okay? And you can be extremely transcendent and sing that song, have it really mean something when you're 60 years of age, as opposed to what it meant when you're 5. But you may sing the song, but you better know the substance of the meaning when you're 60 and 70 and 50 and 43, whatever it happens to be. So this is the pyramid, and this is where life is leading us, and it's not easy. And the question I'm coming now to asking, what happens on any level of this pyramid, whether we're talking about food or we're talking about transcendence, when the need is not met, what happens to us? One word, one brief four-letter word.
Stuck.
That's a five-letter word, but that's good. I like that, okay? Now, when you're stuck, what happens to you? You do what? Well, what happened to you when you're hungry? Have you been hungry? I mean, really hungry?
Like get consumed.
Well, yeah, but give me a simpler word than that. None of you have ever been hungry, have you? All right. Well, what one word? What? How do you feel when you're got that bellyache and that headache and, you know, you just... Only time I was in combat in the infantry and several days with any food on the line. And we got ammunition, but never got the food, you know. You hurt, right? Do you like to hurt? I hope not. You got to be fairly sick cookie if you want to hurt, you know. There are places for people who would like to hurt, you know. That's not very healthy if you want to hurt, okay? No, the normal person does not like to hurt. So let's look through these pyramids and see what we do when these needs are not met. What do you think I would, I'm talking about you because you're all nice people, but I'm not. What would I do when I'm hungry and I've knocked on your back door and said, give me something to eat, and said, John, get lost, we don't have anything. And the Salvation Army ran out of food. There ain't no place where I can get a bite to eat. What am I going to do?
Get angry.
Hmm?
Steal.
Get angry.
Steal.
Well, I get angry, but I'm going to steal. You know, the anger not going to last very long because my hurt is too bad. I'm going to steal a loaf of bread and probably I love cheese, hunk of cheese. Okay? That's what I'm going to do. Because I need to satisfy this need. And I'll do whatever it takes. If I'm out in the cold and it's raining and snow is falling, and now today if you were to come to me and say, John, I got an old coat that I don't need anymore and would you like to have it? You know, come on, buzz off, will you? I mean, I'll be nice in rejecting, but I don't want your old clothes. You're a Salvation Army. But when I'm cold and, you know, and I'm shivering and I'm hurting, and you say, John, I got an old secondhand coat, I said, man, I love you. You see how the perspective changes here? And as Maslow says, when you're hurting enough on the safety need and your security is threatened, you may begin to love a dictator who takes all these problems away from you. The real alternative.
Interesting comment on that is visiting with people in Germany after the Second World War. There, many of them that still liked Hitler, because he gave them jobs and he gave them security.
He gave them all of that, and he eliminated the chaos that came with the Depression. And it became, and that's how he got to power. He promised them security.
Well, he also gave them identity.
Gave them identity.
Superiority over others.
All of that.
That's not uncommon.
Oh, that's a very deep human need, the need for superiority. You know, he gave them everything, but he certainly played on this tune. And if I do not have a job, and I also don't feel very superior, and you offer me a job, I'm going to take the job, then I want to also feel superior. Hitler did it all. He was a master, I mean, absolute master.
And people felt good about it.
People felt very good about it. And then, you know, we can rationalize anything, the atrocities. I want to share something with you, and it's completely off the subject, but it's an interesting point. How all of us, I believe, can rationalize anything that we do. I was in military government after I was put in limited duty, and I was driving along in my Jeep, rainy day, and saw this woman. She had one arm. Walking along, I stopped the Jeep, and I said, where do you live? And she told me. And so I said, I'll give you a ride, and she hopped in, and said, how'd you lose your arm? And, well, I was in Hamburg in the air raid and didn't make the shelter and something fell down. So I'm so sorry. I felt sorry for her. Felt very sorry for her. Well, dropped her off. And next morning, we used to get sort of FBI-like, most wanted type of thing. Well, we got a whole sheaf of these things. Got them every Monday or Tuesday, when it was. And I looked through and all of a sudden, I said, good gosh, I said, that's the woman I picked up yesterday. I said, this can't be, you know. She was an assistant to Ilse Koch. Now, Ilse Koch was the female concentration camp guard who, commander, who, among other things, would get female inmates pregnant, and then when they were ready to deliver the babies, tie their legs together and see what would happen. Would pump gasoline in the bloodstream of the inmates and things like that. And this lady was her assistant. And I said, well, I just can't, you know. So I drove out to a little shack, and I had the name. And as soon as I called her by her real name, I knew I had her. I mean, you know, she was totally shocked. So I arrested her, and I kept her in our little prison for a few days before I turned over to the you know, our headquarters, because I want to find out something about the psychology of this person. And one of my interrogations, I asked her, I said, you know, how could you do these things that you did? And I listed some of these atrocities. And she said, you don't understand, do you? And I said, no, I don't understand. She said, what you don't understand is these people were something less than human. They were not human beings. They are less than human beings. Same thing that you talked about the other day. And I thought to myself, gee whiz, you know. And since that time, you know, I've been able to rationalize a couple of things in my life.
Yeah,
we do. You know, I'm sure none of you have, but haven't had the need to do that, but I have.
Crime of poverty, people stealing and all this crime in the inner city is, you know, it's pretty easy to understand. Yeah.
So we can rationalize our actions, no matter what they happen to be. Safety need, we're willing to give up our freedom for safety need when we're hurting. And we need to think about this. What does this mean in our society? When we get up to the love need, we're so very willing to trade sex for love. That's what we do in our culture. That's just the in thing right now. And the fact that AIDS is around, from the reports that I read, has not changed this thing one iota at all. And people don't realize that sex is not necessarily equated with love. Sex can be very loving. I have a very strange idea about human sexuality from a Christian point of view. May I share it with you? Okay. From a Christian point of view, primarily, and I'm a big boy, but I mean primarily it is not physical at all. Now, I know it's intensely physical, I know that, but it is not physical at all. From the Christian point of view, what human sexuality says is something like this. Look, here I am. I love you the way I love no one else. And I surrender myself to you in some way in which I do not surrender myself to anybody else. And this surrendering of myself, our union is somehow consecrated. And the significance of Christian sex is not the act itself. Because, you know, if it's just a physical thing, you know, you just finish the sex act and then you burp and you turn over and you go to sleep and that's all there is to it. But in a Christian relationship, what happens is that the sex act, in the act of surrendering to the other person, becomes the glue that binds the lives together. It helps you to then solve, what are we going to do with the kids, you know, who's failing in school? What are we going to do with our limited budget? We can't quite hack it. You know, what are we going to do about this, that, and the other thing? And it's this sacred union between two people that somehow provides God's grace between these two people to provide answers that are difficult to solve. And that's the difference, I think, between merely secular type physical sex, qua physical sex, as opposed to a physical relationship that has a sense of the sacred in it and binds people together and then really makes a communality out of two individuals. So we must realize that simply hopping from one bed into the other is not going to do away with our loneliness. I think that Casanova was a very lonely human being. even though he had a, you know, affair every night, or if one believes it, two or three every night, whatever. I don't know what he had. But that image that this will be fulfilling it all is the erroneous image. It just doesn't work that way with human beings. We're more than that. Let me take self-esteem and self-actualization together, because there's one prevalent escape mechanism. You're hurting when you don't have self-esteem. I mean, we have all been there when we thought that we're, you know, we're just not, our ego is about as high as a toad's hind leg. I mean, we just feel depressed, and we feel defeated, and we feel we're not worth 5 cents. Maybe y'all haven't been there, but I've been there. And life just looks so bleak, you see. And boy, that hurts, doesn't it? Even if you haven't been there, you can imagine that it hurts. You're not you're not getting the recognition that you ought to get, you know. It hurts your ego. You're not getting this, you're not getting the promotion that somebody else got. Whatever it is, your wife doesn't understand you. That hurts your ego. Your husband doesn't understand you. And what's the number one escape mechanism in our society?
Alcohol.
Sure. You come home, you had an argument with your wife in the morning, and the day went real bad, and you open the door, and she looks like something the cab drug in on a rainy day, and he says, "Jeez." You hit that liquor cabinet, and a couple of stiff ones, oh, well, it's all right. Am I out in left field when I say that? I don't think I am.
Very graphic.
I don't think I am. I think that's...
You can use that in terms of any addiction. You know, some
yes,
people
yes.
will not use alcohol.
Right, right. Any addiction.
There are some other addictions that use.
I told my people, you can become addicted to the church. I don't want you here every time the door's open. If you every time there's something wrong with you, you're running away from something. Don't be every time the door's open. It's enough if I have to be. I don't like being every time the door's open. But that's my job. I get paid for it. Don't come around every cotton picking meeting that's called. That can be an addiction. Church groupies, hey, we got them. It's easy for me to go to church to meet and then stay at home with my husband or my wife or my children. It can be an escape mechanism. But I think the most wide escape mechanism is alcohol or other drugs or anything. It can be the cowboys. I mean, you know, my wife accuses me of using that as an escape mechanism. And she's very unsympathetic. The first game we played and lost, I sat in there groaning and moaning and crying, and she had no sympathy whatsoever for me. It just was very, totally deflating. Now, don't you talk to her, Evelyn. I've had enough of that. You're all very cruel. I hope you understand that.
Food's a good addiction.
It's a good addiction. You're kind. I like you. Now, what happens to people who try to push through to find wisdom in life and try to find a transcendence in life, and somehow they can't wrap their lives around this upper level? Kierkegaard had the word for that one. Do you happen to know what it is? Called a meaninglessness. I have seen a few cases, Maslow says, in which it seemed clear to me that the pathology, boredom, loss of zest, self-dislike, general depression of the bodily functions, were produced by intelligent people leading incredibly stupid lives and incredibly stupid jobs. And this is, you know, I think when I was, good gracious, time's almost up, I'm sorry. When I was consulting, I was doing seminars, and this man came up to me after the seminar, and he had a big job. He was a scientist in a very nice corporation, and he was making a lot of money, and just things looked, from the outside, you know, boy, he's something else. And he wanted to talk to me. And so he said, you know, I'm just terrible, terrible. And went through Maslow. And I said, well, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? He said, well, really, I want to buy a little bookstore in Estes Park, and I want to sell books. And I said, well, why don't you? He said, are you crazy? I said, why? is, what do you think my wife would say? You know, here we're country club and you know, the whole schmear that goes with the kind of lifestyle. And I said, have you ever asked her? He said, no. I said, don't talk to me. I said, I can't help you. I said, now, first thing you ask her. Now, after she gives you an answer, then I'll be glad to talk to you, but there's no use wasting our time until... I said, I'm not married to you. I could care less. And he said, well, I can't do that. And I says, well, stew in your own juices. You know, if you can't do that, what kind of marriage have you got? Well, he said, boy, you're making me think. And I said, well, you know, that's what I get paid for. And so came back the next day, and boy, he was there bright and early, and he had a glow on his face that you wouldn't believe. He said, you wouldn't believe this, John. I said, what happened? He said, I asked her, and she said, I wondered when you were going to ask me. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, I said, well, okay, resign your job. Give him a month, 2 months, whatever is decent for your particular kind of job. And I'm going to ask this park, who needs to come to play? And for years and years and years, I'd get Christmas cards from them. A little bookstore, you know, making nothing. But that's what he wanted to do, you see. He was wrestling with this meaninglessness that totally destroyed the big house, two cars, three cars, and the private school for the kids, and everything else that he had, this job that he had. A lot more to be said about the pyramid, but you need to realize that life pushes you on up and can't push you down, you know, in the pyramid, and that you're going to hurt. And that you need to think through, and we'll talk about a little bit of that tomorrow afternoon, and what can we do to find this self-esteem. I'm going to return to that quite heavily tomorrow, when in the midst of the difficult times of life, it seems that I'm not all together. Okay?
What time is that going to be at?
Hmm?
What time tomorrow?
According to my schedule, 11:45.
Oh, good.
Okay. So we'll talk about that 11:45 tomorrow. All right? Well, it's been a wonderful group. Thank you so much. We'll see you then. Take care. Bye-bye.